This is part three of a three-part podcast.
So, next up I got on my list here is that the face of the Wofati 0.8 has been upgraded. And Jesse Grimes did that. I think he did a lovely job. I think it looks so much better. And the interior walls of Wofati 0.8 have been removed. Or not all of them, but a bunch of them. I mean, it used to be kind of like you'd go in, and even though there's a lot of glass, it looked kind of dark inside. But now it's very bright and very open and very lovely in there. Yeah. So I think Wofati 0.8 is looking much better. Another note I have is how we recently supported Free Cycles in a fundraiser that they were doing. And so we get to have 10 bicycles and a bicycle workshop and fully stocked with parts for repairing bicycles. And my understanding is that all arrived before today, but maybe not.
I just picked up some of the bikes. The rest will be picked up later.
Okay.
Kaya's going to work on that. But yeah, we've got... They started giving us the bikes. They're picking the best one, so it's going to take a little longer because they want quality over quantity. So
Which is amazing and awesome. I mean, it's... Base camp is about a mile away from the lab, but that's as the crow flies. And so if you're going to ride a bike, you're going to go down the roads, and that's about 2 miles. So if you walk it, like you can walk from the teepee to the front door of the Fisher Price house in about 40 to 45 minutes. So on a bicycle, it goes about 10 times faster. So that doesn't quite make sense. It can't be 10 times faster.
It's like 12 or 15 minutes.
You think it's, so yeah, you ride your bike a lot.
Yeah, most of the time.
But so is it half the time then? Maybe a little less than half the time.
You said most?
Most of the time. I bike most of the time.
Right. So I'm trying to think, okay, 40, 45 minutes, 12 to 15 minutes.
Oh, it's like a third of the time.
Okay, so a third of the time or maybe less. But anyway, there's a fair number of people that have been riding bikes back and forth. And I think it's a fairly easy little bike ride.
It's got a steep hill there once you get up to the lab. I'm not as athletic as Fred. I'm sure Fred just like powers up that whole hill nonstop, but I usually stop and I can get off and walk. I'm kind of
Get off at the gate and walk around the gate.
Yeah, you just like slide under the gate.
But yeah, I just put it in the lowest gear and I just go slow and steady the whole way. But I don't go fast up the hill. That's Kai. Kai does that.
Does he power up there pretty quick?
He's usually waiting for me if we bike together.
Wow. Yeah, somebody else asked, but wait, there's a hill, and it's a bumpy dirt road. And I'm like, a lot of people bike it. It's pretty awesome.
It's super fun going down the hill. It's like a roller coaster ride. I'm usually riding the brakes the whole time, trying not to like go off the cliff and die. But if you're like really hardcore, you could just downhill the whole way.
I usually hit the brakes a little, but I like to go a little faster than terrifying.
But it's just mountain biking. That's all. That's all. Paul's clearing through his notes. I have apple crisp that'll be done in about 10 minutes.
Smell some cinnamon.
So we did get some food this year. And from all of the stuff that we grew last year that was perennial, and plus a few other things from last year. And we got some food from the stuff that we planted this year, even though the rain didn't come. And I think it's fair to say we didn't really irrigate. There was one time when we tried to get out there with the fire truck, but it was like...
Maybe twice. Didn't we run the sprinklers on the top twice?
Did we hit these booms out here twice?
I'm not sure.
But, you know, compared to a lot of people who are like, oh, I got to get out there and irrigate every week. It's
or almost, every day.
Or every day. Yeah, it's like nothing. That we maybe did it twice.
But yeah, we got a bunch of potatoes and some squash and...
lots of daikon. And the daikon greens are awesome.
Yeah.
Lots of
and then a lot of kale.
Kale.
This fall.
Kale. Oh, yeah?
Daikon. That was the most... Well, that's the most food I got was some daikons. Garden I planted.
Nice.
So it seems like we got a fair amount of food out of our systems, you know, from whatever. I mean, but the thing is that we really, on our food systems, we kind of did too little too late. I mean, the paddock was finished in early June, and the problem we were suffering from is that the turkeys would come through and just wipe out every sprig of greenery.
Yeah, if it wasn't the turkeys, it was the deer. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, the deer would come by, like, once every couple of months, like, right down to the house here at base camp. But the turkeys were, like, circling every 30 minutes. And there's, like, 100 of them.
Well, and I might have, I think I mentioned this in a podcast before. They're so destructive and they don't like to fly. I mean, Evan talked about seeing them flying, but so they would walk along the top of the 12-foot-tall hugel culture berms around the house here, and then instead of flying off of them, they would ski down the sides and end up pushing all the dirt and seeds down. And because we didn't have them mulched yet, because we were trying to get stuff started, we didn't have them mulched yet, so they were just really destructive.
Right, 'cause you got those finished kind of late in the year to last year.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah.
And while we're talking about turkeys, I mean, the thing about the dead turkey, it was a bit of a mystery. We needed to call in Hercule Poirot to figure out why is there a dead turkey at our front door. You know, did it get sick? And so Fred found out it had a broken back and a broken wing. And it was over the next few days that, because I would usually go out to the office before dawn, and that's, you know, the office is outside. I got to go outside to get to the office. And so one day I'm going out there, and it's at dawn, like early dawn, just starting to get a pinch of light. And the turkeys are way up on the mountain, and they're all soaring down and making all their turkey noises, and there's oodles of them. And while I was there, one of them, their feet hit that fence at the top of the berm, and I saw two of them hit power lines. It's like you hear this smack, and then there'd be like this bunch of feathers falling, and then a turkey kind of, whoa! And so it's like, oh, that's what happened. So one of the turkeys must have been flying a little low and...
Didn't see the fence.
Hit the fence.
Just right.
Biffed. Died. And then we had a dead turkey at our doorstep in the morning.
Yeah. And we were... I just didn't feel I knew enough to tell how it might have died. So we chose not to...
Do an autopsy?
Or try to harvest it for our kitchen. So we released it back into the wild.
Well, I think Paul's initial inspection of it, you guys didn't see any blood on it.
Right.
And it wasn't until I was, like, manipulating it that I could tell, like, oh, that wing is flopping, it's broken, and then I could feel its back is also broken.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So we got one paddock put up. And so now this one paddock won't be totally safe from the turkeys. It will be totally safe from the deer. But it's like the impact of the turkeys on this paddock will probably be reduced by 99%.
Yeah. There was a turkey that got stuck in it the other day, and all of his buddies were on the other side of the junk pole fence, and he was hysterical trying to figure out how to get out there to where his buddies were. He wasn't trying to eat or destroy the hugel berms. He was just trying to figure out how to get out back to his buddies. And then I think Paul yelled at him, and he finally flew over the fence.
Some giant doofus in overalls came around the corner, and it turned out that the turkey has a giant doofus in overalls phobia and just took flight and then managed to just fly right over the fence then.
Gee. So yeah, I helped remember, him learn. He remembered he could fly.
Yeah, suddenly. It's like, there we go. There we go.
So I don't think they're going in that paddock very often. They get a little distressed.
But I'm glad to hear that the fence is able to, like, kill turkeys and deliver them to your doorstep. That's, like,
what a
stacking
gift,
functions.
Huh?
On the day that I was watching the turkeys biff that power line and then hit their feet on the fence, I was kind of thinking, like, this could be a wild turkey harvesting system.
Yeah, the tops of the fence is kind of like a palisade. They're kind of pointy. You just, like, just have a bunch of turkeys.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't take much to just pull five of them out of the air, and yeah, and Thanksgiving just recently passed, but you know, Christmas is coming. You know, turkey for Christmas. All right, now we had all those problems with the turkeys obliterating every speck of green, so we planted a bunch of stuff that was supposed to grow through the winter, and we never got to see it because the turkeys would just wipe it out. And then we had the weird June where the stuff we planted didn't really grow. And we didn't really have everything fully mulched yet. But I also kind of feel like mulching is best done after July 1st. Because otherwise you're just kind of holding all the cold into the soil. So there has been a lot of mulching done since July 1st.
A lot. Fred and Kai did a lot of mulching.
Then we went from having... it's like we solved the turkey problem, the deer problem for that paddock, but then everything is still getting utterly wiped out. And it's like any time that I would walk by a berm, it seems like it would be infested with like 25 chipmunks. And there was a few rabbits here and there, and it's like, so they are now obliterating everything. And then it got to be this one point in time. And then, of course, the thing I'm thinking of, and of course, everybody's talking about, like, well, let's get some traps out, and maybe we should get a cat, which I think we should not get a cat until we get rid of all the sand. So we've got sand in places, and until that sand is gone, or it's got growies coming out of it or something, I don't think a cat is a good idea.
I think there's a cat hanging around anyway.
There is. I've seen it.
It left a present for us in front of the shop.
It's making some sort of editorial comment?
Oh, it's a headless bird.
Oh, a headless bird. Okay. Maybe, that sounds like a gift.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking it might have left cat shit, which I think is an editorial comment.
I think it's leaving that on the driveway.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's leaving us a gift and an editorial comment.
Well, helping the Hugo culture, maybe.
Oh, okay. All right.
Some nutrients.
So, then it got to be a point in time where it seemed like we went from 25 chipmunks down to, like, 3. And that's when we found... Who found the vole?
The stoat?
The stoat. Yeah, who found the stoat?
I don't know if someone saw it before me, but I there was a dead stoat on the path.
On the turtle path.
Yeah, on the path of the turtle lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how it died, but...
Didn't it have some puncture holes in it?
It did, like a raptor got it. Some kind of raptor got it, I think.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. And the chipmunks have been making a little bit of a comeback for a while, but then winter came, and that surely fucked up their shit. Now, there's still one rabbit out there once in a while.
More than that, I think.
Well, there's one rabbit, like, here next to the house. I think there's another one down by the red cabin.
Yeah.
And I keep hoping that cat will soon solve that. I think somebody was saying that the cat lives down in the boneyard.
I've seen it coming and going there a couple times. I don't know.
All right.
Maybe just hunting.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, so...
Critters.
Yeah, in time. So we've got a pest, which was chipmunks and rabbits. And then in time, the predators for those show up. And solve the problem.
Like up on the lab, I was bow hunting some chipmunks and feeding them to Sir Chops.
That's right.
I think it was 6 chipmunks.
How many chipmunks were living in the pen with Sir Chops?
Apparently a few. Like, he wasn't that great at catching them himself, but I would see chipmunks in there, and they would eat some of the leftovers that he would leave behind, at least initially. And then I didn't see very many more after I started feeding him chipmunks. Maybe he got the idea that, like, these are pretty good.
Good. All right. That's the thing about
pests.
That's
pretty good to hit those with a bow. Bow and arrow, I think.
So I need to go onto the St. Lawrence Nursery website soon. And it's one that I've ordered from on my last farm, Oodles. And they've got that sweet sap silver maple. I'd like to get 3 or 4 of those and get those planted. And so we can get them started here. What?
They were sold out last month. I don't know when they get them in stock. But I looked at it like a month ago.
Are they sold out for 2016?
No, just like they didn't have any in stock.
So okay.
I don't know when they dig them to, you know, like what, didn't say anything like available in April. It didn't say anything on there. It just said out of stock.
So I prefer to grow apple trees from seed. And I think we've done a few of this where we've brought in a bunch of apples and then we saved all the seeds. And I believe Kai may have gone out and planted those seeds.
He's planted a lot of apple seeds.
Yeah.
And
awesome.
Apricot bits and all kinds of tree seeds.
So, yeah, we're getting a lot of seeds and pits in the ground.
It's a little hard to do it now.
Now, of course, St. Lawrence Nursery, I mean, they're in, like, Zone 3, so very cold area. And in the past, what I would do is I would order trees from them that were winter keepers. So they've got, they categorize their trees by, I think, like, 20 different things. So some are, the apples are good for pie, and some are good for applesauce. Some are good for fresh eating. So they've got this, you know, all these different varieties of apples for all these different things. And, of course, you know, it's all grafted stuff.
Right.
And it's like, but they've also got a category for winter keepers. And I'm kind of thinking that what would be probably be good to do is this year, let's order a bunch of the sweet sap silver maples and let's order a bunch of the winter keeper apples. We can plant them in the berms and hugelkultur beds here at base camp. And then when they throw off fruit, then all of the fruit will be winter keepers. And so when we go and plant all those seeds, our probability of what comes up to be a winter keeper is much higher, which is going to be, it's going to be more difficult to get a winter keeper than like a fresh eating apple or whatever, because of course, the child isn't going to be true to parent, but it will be true to parent sometimes.
Right. And they don't sell the winter keepers as often at the stores or markets. It's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm thinking like that's a good one to have. I'd also like to get yellow transparent, but that's because my granddad had a yellow transparent. Mm-hmm. And yellow transparent's kind of cool because it comes on in July. And while they don't keep very long or anything like that, it's always awesome to start having apples in July. All right. Living Fence Project. What's the status on our Living Fence?
We got most of it, almost all of it here at base camp mulched and ready for planting, but the place I ordered most of the seeds from didn't tell me that they didn't have most of them in stock. And so they sent a partial shipment, and they said some of them aren't going to be in until March. And so I was like, well, we wanted to plant them this fall so that they'd overwinter, it's cold stratify in the ground, but that wasn't possible. Because we, you know, if we have 10 or 12 species that we want to plant, and we only plant 3 or 4, it would be a weird spacing on the fence that we'd have to maintain.
Right, right. That can get weird quick.
You have to remember where you put them all, too.
Right, right.
Do a lot of marking, or something.
So then we went into the Innovators event. So, wow, we're making good time getting through this list. And at the Innovators event, then there were 2 rocket mass heaters made for tiny houses. And so those would be... P Peter Vandenberg's stuff. Oh!
Three.
Well, there, Peter made Minnie Mouse and the Fat Rabbit.
Right.
And so right now we're currently planning on putting Minnie Mouse in the Red Cabin once the installation's done. And then we're talking about possibly upgrading the garage to be more of a community space, and then the Fat Rabbit will go in there. And then there's the thing that Erica made with the help of Peter, mm-hmm. which is kind of like, and this is for use in the hot tub, and so it'll be a somewhat submergible pocket rocket of sorts.
Yeah.
The innards are non-metal, because the problem we have with pocket rockets is the metal burns out. The metal on the inside burns out, so we no longer allow pocket rockets. So she basically made a small pocket rocket where the innards are not metal, and but it's like, this thing is so versatile, it's like, oh, some days it's used to heat a hot tub, and other days it could be used to heat, oh, I don't know, the Love Shack. Right. So so we kind of have three tiny house rocket mass heaters, but two of them are built by Peter, and one of them was built by dominantly Erica, but with some help from Peter. Then there's the hot tub, which... It's really a miracle that we have it at all. We had a guy that said that he was going to take care of it and I shouldn't worry about it. And I think what he meant to say was, I'm going to not do anything. You better do something about it. Because then the event got here and we didn't have a hot tub. So Weston found a hot tub on Craigslist and went out and got it and brought it here. And worked on...
A wood hot tub.
A wood hot tub.
Because your standards are different than some people's, so...
Yeah, I didn't want to get some kind of weird plastic thing or...
Fiberglass
mm-hmm. thing. And so many of those hot tubs, they just... They look like something that doesn't meet permaculture standards. Like, it's made out of a lot of glues and gunks and nozzles and stuff. And it's like, so... Weston found one that was redwood. And we got to the point that it got built, and it got, and he built a platform to put it on, and so it's on the platform. And then when they went to go put water in it, it didn't exactly hold water well. But it's like, it's not that it won't hold water well, it's that there's a process that you go through to get it to hold water well. And so that process will still need to be done, possibly... when the weather warms up, then we might have a rocket hot tub. But there's other things that people do to heat a hot tub with wood, but they tend to be pretty smoky, and they use a lot of wood. So we're hoping that we'll be able to this thing that Eric has built will be very clean, and it will use very little wood to heat that much water. And she's trying to design it in such a way that it's possible that solar could be used to help preheat the water, or a compost pile could be used to preheat the water. Another thing that happened at the Innovators event was that we had a quartz, I'm going to just say the word barrel for now, it's not really a barrel. But
it goes where you use a barrel in a rocket mass heater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's clear.
Yeah.
It's clear.
Yeah.
So the idea was to be able to see the Taurus. So I understand that we have a lot of video footage of it, and I haven't seen it yet. Did you guys see it at all?
It was a little underwhelming. I think it, like, the initial part of a burn of a rocket mass heater isn't as clean as it gets a little bit later once it's starting to heat up. So I think that initial burn, the particulate sort of, and it's the barrel part where it doesn't get as hot, so it didn't burn it off, and so it just kind of got dark, smoke colored, and then there was some glow at the top of the heat riser. But the real action, I think, is going on inside the heat riser that you'd want to see. So unless you had a clear heat riser too, it wasn't as exciting as people were expecting. I think.
Yeah, and the Taurus is the action of the smoke around the sides. You know, the idea is that the smoke has quite a bit of motion, and that's called Taurus.
Oh, but Dan had a really sweet what was it, infrared camera or
yeah, his camera like had that. Some infrared capabilities.
So that was really cool to see. You could see the whole...
You could see through the soot.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, well, that's neat. Yeah.
You got some footage of that. It should be awesome.
And then Erica built, you know, because of course we've talked many times about an 8-inch system, a 10-inch system, a 6-inch system. And then we have talked in the past about how it might not be wise to build a 4-inch system because there hasn't been one built yet that didn't have issues. And so Erica built a 2-inch system. And I don't know how well that went. It seems like I heard that it ran. It didn't run fantastic.
You had to kind of burn like toothpicks in it, pretty much.
Yeah, you had to put, you know, you could put like one little Doug fir cone in there. One of the problems that she said was that even though the mechanics of the airflow scale down to that small, the insulation doesn't scale. So you were still losing too much heat through the fire brick. You needed, and she hadn't insulated around it. So it's possible to have a cleaner burn with that 2-inch system, but I don't know if you could have any mass attached to it. But you would still need really tiny wood.
Well, even still, I mean, like, let's say we had something that was a 2-inch system and you could vent it to the outside. And now let's suppose that you're sitting at a desk and there's a window there and you've got, like, some kind of something set up so it vents out to the window.
Maybe like a pellet stove fuel. So it's just like little tiny additions or something.
I mean, it's possible that you could have like a little something that kind of warms you at your desk.
Right.
And then the temperature generally is turned down. But I can't help but think that it's going to be ridiculous. It's going to not be very practical.
It was cute.
Yeah. But like you're saying, the scale of the insulation, you'd have like huge blocks of insulation for like a tiny little stove to get the right proportions because it doesn't scale.
And then the wood that you'd be putting into it would be so tiny that you'd have to be just refeeding it every minute or so.
Probably even less than that.
To keep the fire going. And then on top of that, I don't think the fire would ever get hot enough to get a proper, thorough combustion going on.
Well, that's why the insulation was needed. It was like, it wasn't a...
No, yeah, you could have this enormous amount of insulation, but it's like you'd have to, even if you ran the fire for an hour and a half, constantly feeding it, I still think it wouldn't get hot enough to, like, do a full-on combustion,
right. Even
if you met all that criteria.
I got some 3-inch stovepipe for her, and we put that on top of the system, and it definitely changed the way that the fire was burning, but we couldn't decipher why the flames looked one way, because sometimes the flames would be coming out the top of a 2-foot section, or if you moved it away, the flames had a weird like striation, and then sometimes they would look like flames, and sometimes they would look like this other weird fire, and we couldn't decipher why the fire was burning that way.
So... there was a 2-inch system built, and it was a novelty, and there was weird things that happened. And it's like, I guess where I'm going with it is like, okay, there's things we can learn from running a 2-inch system, but I doubt there's going to be much practical value in a 2-inch system.
We should say that Peter's two tiny house heaters were a 5-inch base system.
I thought one of them was a 4-inch.
Well, I think the ducting was all 5-inch.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I think the J-tube on one of them was a 4-inch box.
But okay.
The ducting was 5.
So, and I had a very, very long conversation with Peter, which I recently got subjected to as we're editing the DVDs, where... like with the systems that he made, they don't get particularly hot on the inside because they're such smaller systems. Mm-hmm. And so the materials he's using, he can kind of travel some paths that we normally don't travel because it's not going to get that hot on the inside. He's still not using metal on the inside, which is so very important. But he's using some of that vermiculite board, which I think that, you know, if we got to the temperatures that we're seeing like in this rocket mass heater here, then that vermiculite board would just, layers of it would just keep melting out until it melted all the way through.
Crumble away.
Yeah, it would not do well. But, you know, for his particular system, because it didn't get very hot, because it was such a small system, then it would still work. We kind of went over the numbers and did the math, and it would still be okay, even though it's like there is some concern about if it did get hot, there would be failure.
You can only add a certain amount of fuel to it, so you can only generate a certain amount of heat.
So then there's the thing about that Lhasa made, and at the beginning I didn't know what he was making, and then he started making it like in the main area, and then he's saying he's going to move it. So apparently when he moved it 3 feet.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to, like, you know, I don't know what he's going to build, but in hindsight I would have liked to have been able to say, okay, let's finish building it where we can use it when it's done being built. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's kind of built in the middle of this main area. Apparently now it's going to have to be taken apart. And so Evan's talking about possibly in the spring taking it apart and rebuilding it at a final destination, which might be Wafati 0.8. But it might be, I don't know, maybe Allerton Abbey. I don't know. We haven't nailed that one down yet.
It has to be protected from the weather somewhere inside.
Yeah, it's got cob in it, so it's not going to get along with rain stuff.
Well, it basically works as an outdoor kitchen. It's got a cook surface, like a griddle area, you know, that's wood-fired. And
it has a white oven, which means the food is not exposed to the combustion gases.
Right.
And then it also had a mass bench attached to it. And it's really beautiful.
It is.
But it's not, you know, where we can use it.
Not in a good place. Yeah, I learned what a white oven and a black oven is this Innovators event. So you explained that well. So a pizza oven is a black oven.
Right.
So, or most of the way the pizza ovens are made. So, which it's pretty amazing to have a white oven. In a wood structure like that, wood soap,
I wish that Tim Barker didn't sacrifice the previous oven that he had in order to make this year's oven. I thought it would have been nice to have two. But oh well. Okay. Anything else about the Innovators event?
No.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else either. The event before the Tinkerer Circus was kind of a face plant. We thought that there would be people who would show up and say, look at what I made, and it would be kind of like this show and tell thing, but people didn't do that. Instead, the regular innovators just made stuff.
They started early,
yeah.
We didn't talk about the rocket kiln.
That's right. That was Ernie's big creation. It was the rocket kiln.
Besides the glow bug.
Oh, right. Yeah. So now we have a kiln. It's rocket powered. We haven't tried to put anything through it yet. You know, they've done some test burns with it and stuff, and, you know, it's there.
Yeah.
So hopefully somebody will be here who's a potter and will want to, you know, do some amazing, exciting things.
Yeah, you could harvest clay on the lab.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it was that Ernie wanted to make stuff out of ceramics that would then be used to build rocket mass heaters.
Oh.
And I'm not sure what he has in mind, but I'm looking forward to seeing what that is. All right, next on the list. We had a guy here who's a timber frame construction guy. And he was saying, so he was looking at the berm shed and Allerton Abbey and Wolfati 0.8 and some of the other structures that we've made. And one of the things he said that was really interesting is that he does not concern himself with green log shrinkage lengthwise. It's been his experience that the shrinkage lengthwise is so incredibly small, it's not worth worrying about. And so he would even be willing to bet that for, you know, like we were looking at something that was 20 feet long, and he was saying, like, if it shrunk anything measurably, it would be less than half an inch. Whereas everything that is my understanding is that lengthwise stuff tends to shrink about 3%. Now, laterally, the thickness-wise of a log typically shrinks about 7%. And he said that that's his experience, is that about 7% is about right. It shrinks about that much. Mm-hmm. But lengthwise, he's like, it's so close to zero, don't even worry about it. I thought that was fascinating. Next! We're currently shopping for a natural builder. Actually, there's three positions that we would like to fill. In fact, if we got three natural builders here, I think that would be awesome. Because surely, if there were three here, two of them would find out that they hate my guts or something and go, or vice versa. And then we'd still have one here who's doing awesome. But I outlined a bunch of threads out at Permies where I believe that each of these three positions could generate professional levels of income in the first year. And so for one position is natural builder, and of course I'm open to having several natural builders come out. Another position is what we call resort manager. They would manage classes and people coming and going to the different structures and stuff like that. And then the third position would be educator. And so this would be somebody who could teach a PDC, but mostly I want to see the PEP 1 program get off the ground. And basically, you know, they might even have year-round students that would pay to be part of their college, but it would be their college. But I would be willing to put money into each of these positions to get them off the ground. But it's like I'm not going to pay somebody $100,000 a year and then they show up and then they kind of just, you know, want to visit with people and that's all that they do.
Or worse yet, say, what do I do now?
Oh, yeah. But instead, I think I've laid out a plan for each of these positions where it's like there could be something to get things off the ground. And then it's like, you know, here's a plan on how they would basically do a business. And I would support their business. And here's how much money, you know, a general business plan. So that way, both of us would profit. And, yeah. So that's some more details about each of those positions out at Permies. Any more comments about those positions? Nobody? Okay. No,
just, you know, yeah. You said it well. I thought I had more to add, but I don't really.
There's a lot to be said for each one.
Yeah.
But I think that if we're going to talk about it in a podcast, we should have all that stuff with us and go over it. Yeah. I want to just go ahead and read this thing. Bill the Dowser was here on Monday, and this was several months ago. He picked two spots where he was certain that there would be water within 10 feet. We dug. My excavator can dig a 16-foot deep hole in about 20 minutes. No love on either hole. Bill says he is going to be back soon and douse a big north-facing slope. He feels confident that he can uncover a couple of springs there. Okay, so that was a couple months ago. He hasn't been back. He had some vehicle trouble in the beginning, and I haven't heard anything since. So hopefully he'll come back perhaps in the spring and try this game again. Game cam. Actual game on the game cams. We got one more, so we have three game cams now.
Right.
So, dear mountain lions, and we no longer call them cougars.
You don't. A lot of other people still call them cougars.
A bear. We got a bear on one.
A bear? Yeah, we got a bear. Moose, elk, wild turkey, coyote. And I think that, you know, over in Pullman, Washington, there's the Washington State University. And they go by the Cougars, which they've been using mountain lions as their mascot. And I think that they have to change it to, you know, like a 35-year-old woman now. In high heels and
nobody here is laughing, Paul.
Yeah, I'm no entertaining myself.
That. Yeah, no one's laughing.
Okay. The daikon radishes, apparently I've got a note here about fermented foods.
Oh, a lot of ones I harvested I used to make kimchi, and then I pickled some for using in nori rolls.
Awesome.
I've got we did on the Rocket Mass Heater 4 DVD set, we did a price reduction, and so the digital download is currently $29.50 to get all 4 DVDs, and the physical DVDs, the physical 4 DVD set is currently $49.50. And those are also the exact same prices for the World Domination Gardening 3 DVD set. So those things are now available for a lot less money, just in time for Christmas! And the cards, we finally did the reprint. And we got 10,000 decks of cards a little over a week ago? Is that right? No, a week and a half ago. And so a bunch of people had pre-ordered the cards for when they arrived, and we got those all shipped out. That turned out to be a lot more work than we originally thought, or what I originally thought. And then it took forever to get the cards out to Amazon, and I think that they arrived at Amazon today. And I think the price of the cards now is about half of what they were 2 years ago, because we're trying to get them into more homes, more brains, more everything. We did update the cards a little tiny bit, not a whole lot. I think probably we changed some of the wording on 7 or 8 cards. But the backs are a little darker now, and there's been some, like on the box now it says second edition.
There's some birds above the tree on the back. I think those were there before.
Actually, were there before, different. But they kind of ended up so light you didn't really notice them. Mm. Ah. And so Alexander wanted to darken them up a little this time so that you can spot them easier.
It worked.
So awesome. We got in 10,000 decks. I think 3,000 of them have left the building. So we've got 7,000 to go. So I hope you guys, like, want some cards, because we've got boxes and boxes. They got to go.
They do make great Christmas gifts. Last Christmas, from the first edition set, that's what I got everybody for Christmas. It was really easy. Awesome. Just got a brick, gave it out to everybody that I had
Christmas gifts. Awesome. And you made up your own game to go with cards.
I did make up the permaculture pie party game. And you can, that's on Permies, you can see the rules and stuff. Maybe it'll get developed further, but awesome. Right now you can make all the pieces yourself out of trash and stuff.
That's awesome.
It's fun to play.
Awesome.
Okay, next up is, we encountered a point in time, and this is kind of a quick little trivial thing, and then we'll get back to the more substantial stuff in a moment, where we had a drain in the Fisher-Price house that was not draining properly, and I was shocked at myself that the first thing I wanted to do was, okay, my thought process was, what I want to do is I want to say my thought process was fucked up. And so I want to start there. My first thought was pour a chemical into the drain, eat away whatever's in the drain that's plugging it. You know, so basically I'm thinking Drano, but I'm thinking like I'm not going to actually use Drano. What's the organic substitute for Drano? And I want to confess that even that is not good. And in fact, the first thing I did was like, oh, I'm going to just put a whole bunch of hot water through it, and then the hot water will maybe, you know, warm up whatever it is and get it to go on, which didn't work. I even tried pouring boiling water, but in hindsight, those were all stupid. Those were all just terrible, stupid things. And my brain is miswired when it comes to drains. And finally I remembered what I've done over the last, I don't know, 5-6 years. And it's like, duh. So I went and I got the zip tool, the drain zip thing, which is just a piece of plastic that's about, I don't know, 2 feet long with little barbs on it. And you just shove it down there and pull it out. Total time, about 15 seconds. Way faster than even Drano would be.
Well, and a lot of times what it'll do is it'll pull up this really nasty-looking hairball that you know, then dispose of, not in your drain. But, yeah, it'll
you'll find some compost in your drain.
Yeah,
some compost. So, I guess the thing is that it's like I feel like I'm generally really good at like not going down those, and it's like because of course we got the toxic solution, and then the organic approach is like we're going to do the exact same thing but with a less toxic substance, and then the permaculture solution is to do it without a less toxic substance either. But you know, and oftentimes the permaculture solution is vastly superior, only people don't know about it, and it's like even my brain forgot. And I'm ashamed, and I'm confessing to my crime.
Well, and the zip works far better than what I've used instead of Drano, which is baking soda and vinegar. So,
which I don't even understand how those would even work. I mean, basically, you put the two of them together, it makes foam.
Right, and then you let it foam in there for a while, for like 10 minutes, and then you pour boiling water in on top of it, and it does help dislodge the whatever's, but not as efficiently or effectively as the zip thing.
The drain zip thing. You have a volcano in your sink.
Which is what she does. She makes a volcano in the sink. And the drain zip just is crazy fast, far better, no toxic gick or no half toxic gick. It's just good and simple, and I'm embarrassed and ashamed that I thought of the other things, and I'm glad that's behind me now.
If we can figure out how to make one that's not plastic, that'd be even better.
Ah, there you go.
That's true. I imagine you could do something with bamboo, some kind of flexible bamboo kind of thing.
Like a metal wire?
Metal wire?
That might even work.
Some barbed wire.
Some kind of piece of string steel or something, maybe? All right. There is something at the Innovators event that happened that was very exciting. And I believe when it happened, I was up talking to Evan. And in fact, that's another topic that we haven't touched on, and that is the whole thing of, like, when building Volcano Road, it got to the point where we hit rock that was much harder than all the other rocks. So you got like 98% of the way there and then hit some rock that was like, I don't know, 5 times harder than the other rock, and it's like you couldn't get through it.
Yeah, it was a combination of that and being sort of on the outer, you know, edge of trying to turn around and up a convex curve on a hill. And so I was like already strapped for material, and then the material that I needed to get was solid rock. So I was
almost all of it was solid rock, but the other solid rock you could break with the excavator, beat the crap out of it. But this rock was like not going to put up with that. It's like you needed an excavator that was 20 times bigger than our 14-ton excavator to break this rock. Or some kind of jackhammer attachment or who knows what. This rock was not letting go.
Yeah.
So then we came to the conclusion of like, okay, there's another spot like 200 feet away where the material is much looser. So here's what we need to do. Fortunately, Tim Barker was here. Tim Barker got the Millennium Falcon running. Like, I don't know. It didn't take very long. And he found, like, a bunch of stuff wrong with it. And he fixed it all. Tim Barker is a superhero and awesome. And I'm so glad he was here. So Tim Barker got the Millennium Falcon running. And then it's like, okay, well, how about this? We got Rex down now. And so the other excavator went away, and all the drama that came from that started, and we're still dealing with it. So then we got Rex down here, because the other excavator was like a 6-ton excavator, mm-hmm. and Rex is a 14-ton excavator. And so Rex is much bigger and more powerful, and things go generally faster. So then we got to thinking, like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put material into the Millennium Falcon and go up to that point and drop a bunch of this material off, and we'll kind of, by dropping tons and tons of material, literally, we will make a road go around the rock. And but the thing was is that we had one person lined up, because the Millennium Falcon, that it's a Kenworth, and it's old school Kenworth. It's like from the 70s. You get inside of it, it's like an airplane cockpit. I don't know how to drive it. I know how to drive a lot of equipment, but I do not know how to drive that. I do know it, there's a few things that are a bit different. One is that you need to build up your air pressure to get going. Because if you don't have air pressure, all the brakes are activated. So, our driver looked at the road and said he doesn't trust the road. He's worried that he'll start going up the road and that a piece of the road will slough off, and then the Millennium Falcon will roll, you know, side-to-side roll, not forward-backward roll, but, you know, down the hill in the bad way. And he does not want to attempt it. Even though we've already brought the excavator up and down several times, and the excavator is much heavier than the Millennium Falcon. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion around that, but he's basically like, nope, not going to do it. So then we went to another guy who could drive the Millennium Falcon, and he was worried that the Millennium Falcon would get, like, halfway up, and suddenly the engine would quit, or a wheel would fall off, because the Millennium Falcon, it doesn't look like much, yeah. And it won't do the Kessel run in 12 parsecs. The Millennium Falcon is this kind of a scary-looking thing. Josh stepped up, and he knows how to drive it, and he did it. And it went right up there without a problem. The road was solid. Good job! Evan, way to make a solid road.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of times when you guys had to back the Millennium Falcon up to get a running start at it. Didn't you ride up in there with him?
He demanded that I, if it was going to roll off the cliff, that and it would be my fault, then I should at least be...
Die with him.
Yeah.
Okay. In the cap.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
So, so it went up there. They didn't have any problem in that space. There was a point when it was like the road got a little steep for the Millennium Falcon, so you had to get more of a running start at it. And I think you guys might have fixed that road on the way back down, so it wasn't that steep at that point. And the pod people cannot hear you nod your head.
Oh, yes. It's fixed now, in theory.
Okay. All right. So that was kind of an adventure. And in the end, the Millennium Falcon broke its drive shaft. So it got one load up there, broke its drive shaft, and then there was a lot of frustration, and then I went up there, and I came up with an idea. I'm going to take full ownership of the idea that worked, and I proposed it to you, and you agreed that it might work, and so you tried it, and how did it go?
It was touch and go, but it worked.
Ta-da! What do you mean, do I touch and go?
It was sketchy. I was on the edge of this cliff. I was having to, like, reach down over the edge of the cliff to get the dirt to get to build the road. And it was scary. And then I was like, and then the road was not, like, a good road, but it was enough to get over to the next place where I could get more material and then make the road okay. But it was scary, but it...
And now I predicted... So we were stuck at this one point for, like, days.
Yeah, the 98% point.
The 98% point because of that super hard rock, and we kept coming up with, like, how are we going to solve this, how are we going to solve this?
We moved a whole bunch of material with the tractor that I dug out from further down, sort of building a bridge out over the abyss to get over there.
So there were lots of little ideas and things that were tried, and then there was a lot of work, and then I came up with this idea, and I believe I said, if we do this, and if it works, we could be done in an hour and a half. Now, I think in the end, you added some niceties, and it ended up at 2 hours. Is that, am I exaggerating?
It was maybe 2.5, but it was pretty close.
Solving the big problem, I think the problem was solved in less than an hour and a half. But then finishing all the rest of the niceties and stuff like that, that may have added the extra hour. Fair?
Maybe so.
Okay. I just like the idea that I came up with an idea to solve the problem and it worked. I'm feeling very proud of myself, even if nobody else recognizes it. I thought it was good. Now, back to the day of the exciting day during the Innovators event. So I think I was talking to you and the driver, and I was hearing the driver say... No. I'm not going to go up on that road. That road has not been tested enough. I don't want to be the guy that tests it and have it roll.
And then boom!
Boom! And at first I thought somebody very close by is like hunting the turkeys with a really big shotgun. You know, it's like they're close and they've got an enormous shotgun because that was a big boom.
I thought it was more of like a boom squish because it was an Innovators event.
Oh,
and Tim was working with hot water stuff.
Yeah,
and so was Erica. So it's like, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. But when I first heard it, it didn't even occur to me that it was anything to do with the Innovators event. I'm looking around to try and figure out where's the hunter.
I was a lot closer than you, I think.
No. Yeah, you were.
I was at the showers. I was working on the shower door.
Yeah, you were 70% closer, because I was up at Sherwood Road, and I could see where it happened, but it was a ways away. But I'm looking across the field to see if I can see a hunter out there chasing turkeys, and so I thought the boom was farther away because it was. But anyway, all right. So. We paid a guy to once a month go around and take care of the batteries. And it sounds like what happened is that, you know what's awesome? Is if you can get paid to do a job, but then you just sleep in that day and don't do anything. So apparently what happened was is he was supposed to go around and take care of all the batteries once a month. And he did get paid for it. He collected the pay for it. I didn't go and follow up on him. I made the mistake of trusting him because he did use this phrase a lot, trust me. And so I'm being a lazy bastard, went down the wrong path. I trusted him. So one of the bad boy buggies had not had its batteries maintained for several months. And we believe that what happened was is that the charger was behaving inappropriately and it was boiling the batteries, which was causing it to off gas, while at the same time there was a bunch of corrosive guck on the top. And the corrosive guck happens to be slightly conductive. And it finally got to the point when it was conductive enough that there was an arc in the middle of a bunch of hydrogen gas. And that was the boom. So all of the batteries the tops were blown off of all of the batteries, and we had acid pouring out. And fortunately, Fred got right out there, and we had Randall was there. Randall's a guy who has a lot of experience with solar systems and batteries. And so Tim Barker came out and gave a lot of really excellent advice, but I'd have to say that it was Randall and Fred that did the lion's share of the work to quickly solve this problem before the acid dissolved the bad boy buggy. So there's still some spookiness, you know, still right now it's rusty, but we also put a lot of baking soda on.
Yeah.
I made a quick run to town to go get a lot more baking soda just to make sure that, you know, we're safe, safe, safe.
Yeah, I went down there and I see Fred in front of this barrel. It's like a witch's brew. He's pouring in the baking soda and battery acid, and it's all just like steaming off.
We had to quickly pull all the batteries out of the bad boy buggy, and so we put them into like empty plastic trash cans. But then we had to dilute the acid and.
Yeah, I think by Jocelyn's standards, I think you were trying to open a drain.
We did make a lot of foam.
There's a lot of foam there, yeah. Yeah.
We're just glad there was no squishing with that boom.
Yeah, it was just strictly boom, no squish. And
nobody got covered in acid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been horrible. Although the funny thing is that so I went to town, I got the baking soda, I came right back, and because we had like two huge sacks of baking soda, but we're like, let's be safe, let's get a bunch more. And so I went into town, I got the baking soda, came back, and I think I was back for like 2.5 minutes when Peter cut the fuck out of his hand. And it's like, then Ernie and Erica were right there. Then we had to go find all our first aid kits, which were hidden or something. I could not find them. So finally I ran up to the office and we have one. And then we've got like this box that has all of the extra materials for first aid kits. So brought those all down. So we ended up being okay. But since then, we bought a bunch of first aid, like, what do we got, 6 first aid kits? And they're stuck all over the place?
Of that, like the ones that say first aid kit on them? I think we got 4 of those.
And then we got a bunch of ammo boxes.
Yeah, we got some to build our own.
Yeah, to make better ones, more of them everywhere.
Right.
But Ernie and Erica said that they believe Peter needed to go in and get stitches. And so Peter, of course, is from the Netherlands, where if you're sick or you've got a cut on your hand, then you go into the hospital and they stitch it up and then you go home. But we're in the United States of America, so we had to go, and it was, I got stitches once when I was a kid. I went in, and it was like I was probably out the door in under an hour. And this time they wanted to like do a full medical workup. They wanted to ask all the questions. They wanted to know about all the shots he's ever had. It's like they went on and on and on asking questions that seemed to be totally unrelated to. And then they just kind of seemed to turn this thing into like, instead of just getting a few stitches, it's kind of turned into surgery. And then finally, at the end, a doctor showed up. He spent maybe 4 minutes putting in stitches, and that was it. But by the time the doctor put the stitches in, I think we'd been there for 4 hours, maybe 3.5 hours. And then I'm trying to explain how it works to Peter about how they won't tell you how much it costs, how much any of this stuff costs, and you won't find out for weeks, and you'll get this massive bill. And I was thinking, like, if you're going to go in and get, I think you got 4 stitches. If you're going to go in and you're going to get 4 stitches, I'm thinking, like, should be a reasonable price, I think, is $100. But it was $1,000 was what the bill was that we got. And anyway, we got back late, like midnight or something.
Past your bedtime.
Way past my bedtime.
It's so, pumpkin time. That's what I call it. It turns into a pumpkin at 9:30.
Yeah, that was ridiculous. So that was our big adventure in learning about American healthcare. I'm looking at the list.
I making peanut sauce now.
And I got a note here. Evan powered through the volcano project all the way to the end. Saw to it that it got done. You know, there was, I mean, as with any big project.
I almost gave up a couple times.
Did you?
I got to say, I think it was close.
I almost
didn't do it.
Any big project, I think that a lot of people would just walk away from it, you know, and let it go because it's too much. But it's like, for almost any big project, there's going to be problems, and they need to be solved. And some people will solve the problems, and other people will just quit and be like, I'm done. And so, let's see, what else? We got more of the Hoogle cultures here at base camp done because, you know, we had the Millennium Falcon running and everything, and then with Rex up at the lab and a little excavator down here, then Rex could bring a bunch of material, or the Millennium Falcon could bring a whole bunch of material down here to the lab because we can't really make Hoogle culture down here because it's all one giant rock unless we bring material from the lab. So we did get this one berm that's been killing me since the day I arrived. We finally got it done. And we've still got some more berms to do and stuff like that, but it's finally done. And it got seeded by Kai and Fred, and shortly after it was built. Here's some notes about Allerton Abbey. It's got new windows and, of course, the big, big doors that we were talking about. The facades are done. So for a while before, one of the facades was not done. So you looked at plastic, the billboard material. And then there's the bounty for finishing it up. And then here's the last little notes that I did for the most recent podcast for Jack. We got ice out here, and to control the ice, the big thing that we've been using is cornmeal or polenta.
Polenta, because it's coarser than the cornmeal, and we put that on. It's a nice grit.
Yeah, and it gives you good traction. And then the wild turkeys come, and they peck and scratch at it, which then usually removes any remaining ice. And then they'll eat whatever's left.
Yeah, and they didn't come around as much this winter because we've been trying to keep them away, and plus we've fenced out the paddock. So they used to kind of make this whole track around the house and go right along the walk and eat all the polenta. So this year they didn't scratch away the polenta as much.
We cut off some of their access.
Right, and then that one broke its back in the fence, so they're like, they didn't come around as much, but it's really awesome to have them scrape the ice away.
So Jesse's got his structure done, but the cool thing is that he's made a series of videos, and he's, I mean, there's a couple of cool things to say about Jesse's videos. I mean, one is like, I like his style. It's kind of like the Dick Prenicky style. He narrates, you know, the video of him building stuff. And it seems like, I mean, he has a gas saw, but of course the ants have that electric steel saw now. And it seems like that electric steel saw, that cordless electric steel saw, is a big hit. It sounds like it's way better than either of my cordless electric saws. Is that true, or have you...
It seems to rock pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, so Jesse's got a full video series, and it looks really cool. I really enjoyed watching the videos. And he's got a Patreon thing set up. And I think he's getting something like $110 for each video that he puts up. I would think he'd be putting up two videos a week. Plus, it seems like the amount he gets per video keeps going up. And then you guys just started a Patreon account.
Yep, we launched a Patreon. It's not just videos. Charlotte is making videos, but I'm also still doing my daily-ish posts with photos, and that's sort of all tied in. So we're doing a monthly thing, and right now we're getting $36 a month, I think, is what we just got. So
it's awesome.
The next thing I got on the list is a little bit of a bitch fest. This has to do with the cards. I kind of thought a clever, because like a lot of people, they put out books and their books get pirated, or they put out a DVD and their DVD gets pirated. And I kind of thought, ha, you're not going to be able to pirate the cards because it's really hard to play cards with a digital version. And so you're going to have the physical cards. So there. And so I thought I was being really, really clever. However, what happened was, is when we got the first batch printed, then Alexander went with a guy that he's worked with many times. And it's like, the guy pretty much guarantees it'll be done first class. It'll be the best possible thing. And so great, yeah. Let's get high quality cards. Let's go with the best quality available. So we ended up paying a fair amount per deck to get them printed. But what happened was is that this guy subcontracted it to somebody where that's all they print is playing cards, and then that company decided that they liked our cards and that they would just go into business for themselves selling our cards. So if anybody has a deck of cards and you open it up and there's a card in there advertising a printer, you have a pirated deck of cards. Those guys took our artwork and they're just printing their own cards. And they do not have permission to do that. They do not have permission to put a card into a deck in any way, shape, or form. And they're just like, just doing their own business. They just took the artwork. So I hope that you'll complain to somebody that, you know, you ended up with, you were advertised one thing and you got another. Because I think, you know, I see they compete with me on Amazon. I've seen them selling their cards on eBay. I don't know where else they sell their cards. They got them on their own website. And I've had, I don't know how many people say, well, you should go and sue them. And it's like, oh, that sounds great. So I dropped 20 grand, and I probably takes 3 to 7 years of hard fighting. And then when I win, then they just sell the company to somebody else for a quarter. And then it's gone. And so it's like, it's not that easy. So anyway, I'm a little pissed about it, but there's not much I can do. But if people were to complain, if people bought the pirated cards and they were to complain, that might help. All right. Leaving behind that negative Nelly thing, look, we're on the last page. We've got an experiment going on. Don't know how well it's going to work, but we bought a bird feeder. We bought a bunch of bird food. And then we mixed in a whole bunch of black locust seeds. And I'm kind of hoping that the birds will come and they'll find that the black locust seeds are not all that digestible. And so then they'll go and leave behind a little pat of fertilizer with a black locust seed in the middle of it. And because black locust seeds do require a certain level of scarification, and hopefully little birds will be just the right amount. And then they'll plant them all over the place and we don't have to do anything.
Sweet.
All right. Winter bounties are getting posted. There's bounties about building more paddocks and fence with rock jacks for the winter. Insulating the red cabin. In fact, I think there's a couple fellows down there right now insulating the red cabin as we speak. I need to have 2 rocket mass heater cores built, and I got bounties on those. Overhaul the electric tractor. There's a bunch. I think, what was the bounty on that? Was it? It was over $2,000.
I think it was like $2,450 or something.
Yeah, $2,400. And there's a thread for the bounties out at Permies that people can look at. And skiddable woodsheds. We need a bunch of those. 3 log benches, of course. Signs. Just lists and lists of bounty projects for those people who want to come out here and stay the winter. And we've got bunks available for people to stay in. So, that's it. That's my list. We made it. All right. You guys got anything else to add to this podcast?
We covered a lot of stuff.
We did. My butt is sore.
Yeah, I got a cramp in my leg. I had to stand up for a minute.
Oh, yeah. That looked really bad.
That looked miserable. Hey, well, dinner's ready.
Dinner! If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com where we talk about battery explosions,
dinner,
homesteading, and permaculture all the time.